Yeats in 1913 said that Ireland was like plastic, that it was ready to be moulded.
You're really seeing the end of empire, and Ireland being part of the largest empire in the world was a very important aspect to that.
Dublin had more unskilled workers than any other city on these islands.
What you have is 20,000 households who are living in one room.
I can still smell it. I can remember walking into rooms and they were divided by sheets from the ceiling.
But the great thing that he always talked about was the closeness of the people to one another and the sharing of everybody had.
If Jim Larkin's great achievement was to unite workers in the belief they could actually win better conditions, William Martin Murphy's achievement was to unite employers, Catholic and Protestant, that they could beat the other side.
But soon the strike was seen in terms of a clash between Murphy and Larkin.
Murphy was constantly being lampooned as the viper of Dartry Hall, where he lived, a worker's tyrant.
The curious thing about Connolly and Larkin is that their ideas were absolutely identical, and yet they didn't much like each other.
History was written by men, so an awful lot of women that contributed to Irish society have been written out.
I think it is right that we give fair truck to the William Martin Murphy aspect and on the path it sent us on.
But it was tragic, the way it ends. But Larkin still loved
it. It was a very traumatic experience, but it did give the people of Dublin and Ireland the belief that they could change things.
It's been presented as this great labour dispute and it was a success. It wasn't. It was not a success. These men had nothing. Their families had nothing. Their children had nothing.
It seems to me that you could make a huge parallel between what's happening now in Ireland and what happened in the period before the lockout.
Sometimes I think we look back at the lockout and its legacy and we read history backwards.
There's a real danger of commemoration being a form of nostalgia rather than trying to extract from what happened 100 years ago messages and challenges for today.
Citizens.
Lockout, 1913 to 2013.
I'm standing in what today is called Sean McDermott Street, but at the time of the 1913 lockout, this was Gloucester Street. And my grandmother, Elizabeth Connolly, lived here in a tenement house, number 3 Lower Gloucester Street. I'm Helen Shaw, and in this series, I want to find out not just about the events of 13 itself, but about who and what shaped them. I want to bring to life those opposing characters, union leader Jim Larkin, businessman William Martin Murphy, as well as the other personalities who define this era, James Connolly, Constance Markovich, Delia Larkin, and the Archbishop of Dublin, William Walsh. But most of all, it's a story of the lives of ordinary people, people like my grandmother, citizens in lockout 1913, and today, 100 years later. It's a Sunday morning on Sean McDermott Street, and families, many clearly from Eastern Europe or Africa, are drifting into Mass at the church where the bones of the venerable Matt Talbot rest. Matt Talbot was himself locked out in 13. Further up the street, beyond the last Magdalen laundry to close in Ireland, there's a bus waiting to collect Polish workers for the long overland journey home. It's a street, despite the changes, which still speaks of poverty and hardship. Now, my grandmother's family, the Connollys, came here from Mullingar at the turn of that century. They moved because as a young girl, Elizabeth, or as they called her, Lizzie, nearly died from scarlet fever, which was one of the big killers at the time. Temple Street Hospital, after all, is just around the corner, and there the Sisters of Mercy looked after the children of the poor. So by the 1901 census, 13-year-old Lizzie, her parents, her older sister and three younger brothers are living here in one room. Her father, Thomas, ran his bootmaking business from that same room. Number 3 is long gone, a house of 6 rooms and 8 families, with as many as 10 in one room. When my grandmother came here as a child, this was a tenement street in a city of tenements. But what's Dublin like at this time? I'm with historian Mary Daly of University College Dublin and lockout author Porrick Yeats. Porrick, I know there's about 300,000 people living in the city at this stage, But there's about a third, I think, living in tenements.
Yeah, I mean, Dublin was very concentrated between the two canals. And in this area, there was a particularly large number of tenements. They've gone now, they've been demolished, but the whole city from the Liffey up to Mountjoy Square and then going up to Dorset Street and swinging back round towards the Bridewell and Church Street, that whole area was full of tenements, many of them third-class tenements, which meant they were unfit for human habitation.
Now, as for life in those tenements, the most you'd get in a lot of those tenements would have been a privy in the backyard. I mean, there's a really sad and horrible saying by Cameron, the medical officer of health, which was that a hot summer meant lots of dead babies, because hot summers meant lots of flies. Flies brought infection, and dysentery wiped out enormous numbers of Irish children before their fifth birthday or so like that. And some of the hospitals also provided food and assistance. I mean, Temple Street, for example, it wasn't just kind of treatment for the sick children. They would often have given nourishment, because in a sense, maybe the most important thing you might give to somebody who's sick would be some form of nourishment. It's quite clear that in most households, because the man is the breadwinner, insofar as there's money to buy some eggs or a little bit of bacon or something like that, the man got the protein, the children would got what was left, and the mother often got what was left after that.
Dublin was going through a prolonged depression, so mobile workers with skills emigrated, and they were replaced by Catholic workers from the country who were unskilled. Dublin had more unskilled workers than any other city on these islands. Over a quarter of all adult males over the age of 14 were unskilled.
But Mary, why did these Georgian mansions become tenements?
Basically what happened was, as the 19th century went on, first of all, landed incomes in Ireland didn't do terribly well after 1815. So a lot of landed gentry who had townhouses in Dublin let them go. They couldn't afford to keep them up, or maybe they moved a townhouse to London instead. So these really wonderful houses became vacant. And then in time, those houses didn't really go into the hands of the middle classes. You know, the houses of the elite, they went down to the houses of the very poor.
So 100 years after the Act of Union, Dublin has more slums and unskilled workers than any other part of the United Kingdom. Now, in tracing the roots of the lockout, I'm going back to 1900 and the visit of 80-year-old Queen Victoria, who came to Dublin for a month in the midst of the Boer War. It's a visit that exposes the tensions in the city, not just class and wealth, but also politics. Many Irish nationalists supported the Boers against the British. James Connolly and Maud Gonne publicly protest. The Queen hosts a tea party for 50,000 children. Maud Gonne responds with an anti-royal, pro-Boer event, the Children's Patriotic Treat. 30,000 children attend, including 12-year-old Lizzie Connolly. And she joins Gonne's Inia na Héireann, Daughters of Erin, the forerunner of Cumann na Mór. Victoria's visit highlights the divided identities in the city, with the protests on one side and the applauding crowds on the other. It's a city of soldiers and barracks. The Irish Guards Regiment that you're listening to is formed by the Queen to thank the loyal Irish who fought in the Boer War. And many young Irishmen joined for work, including my grandfather, Patrick O'Reilly, another child of the tenements, who married Lizzie Connolly in 1914 and who was, for a time, an army drummer. I'm with historian Kieran Wallace at Trinity College Dublin. Now, Kieran, perhaps it's often hard for us when we look back to see how much Dublin was knitted into the empire and how it wouldn't have been uncommon for some homes to have, say, both a Union Jack and a picture of Parnell on the walls.
Absolutely. I think the sense of identity to be a good Irish man or a good Irish woman was a much different definition then than it might be seen today, looking backwards through history of the War of Independence. So being a good Irish man could incorporate being an RIC policeman or a Dublin Metropolitan policeman. You could be out waving a Union Jack for the visit of the Queen or King Edward in 1907, but standing beneath a banner which says Cade Mhilleadh Fáilte. And that was certainly the average nationalist probably favoured home rule and felt that the Union, the 1800 Union, wasn't a great deal for Ireland. But there was no burning desire amongst the vast majority of people to break free from the entire connection. It was seen as actually economically and politically being essential to be part of this huge worldwide empire. And the notion of seeing it as the British, their empire, a different empire, that's how we might see it today. It was our shared empire. Certainly it was seen as England had the corner of the market on the main control of it. But Scottish people, Welsh people, Irish people were intimately involved in the running of the empire. That have that sense of identity and imperial identity alongside a desire for home rule, they could sit side by side. I think what you're saying about seeing, say, Union Jacks in a house or having a son in the British Army and having a daughter, maybe a typist in, you know, some government department, but also having a picture of Parnell on the wall, those things were not incompatible. It was a much more sophisticated and layered sense of identity than we think of today. And that notion of going out to wave at the Queen, going by, seeing you as being a loyalist or somehow a Seanine or a traitor to the Irish cause, that lens, I think, is a lens that's applied post-1916, really. But I think our grandparents and great-grandparents wouldn't have seen it, the average person wouldn't have seen it that way particularly.
In the lonely woodland of Avondale.
Kieran Wallace mentioned home rule, and Ireland post-1890 is grappling with the loss of Charles Stewart Parnell as a leader and the split in his party.
He sacrificed his health and fortune, his native country to emancipate.
Now, Parnell dies in 1891, but it's not until early 1900 that the Irish Parliamentary Party reunites under John Redmond. I'm with UCD's Professor of Modern Irish History, Dermot Ferriter, at the National Library.
What you get in the aftermath of Parnell is a vacuum because of that level of control, leadership and discipline that was there in the 1880s is gone. There are all sorts of different individuals who are scrambling around to try and take charge of the legacy of Parnell and the legacy of Home Rule. And of course, the party was very divided as a result of the controversies and scandals surrounding Parnell in his last years. So what you're getting then in the early 20th century, in the first decade of the 20th century, is the recovery and the renewal and the reunification of the Irish Parliamentary Party. John Redmond is there as the leader. And the question is now, can they continue that legacy? And those issues are still central. Can you make Home Rule the dominant issue in Irish politics? And can you use British politics in order to achieve Home Rule? Culminating, of course, in 1910, you look at the situation regarding the alliance between the British Liberals and the Irish Home Rule Party. And again, Redmond could have been confident that he would bring the Irish Parliamentary Party where Parnell had brought it in the 1880s, but then go that one step further and actually get that prize of a commitment to legislate for Home Rule, which is exactly what he gets. And he could have been confident around that stage that this is something that could actually be delivered on.
It's that prize of Home Rule and its glittering potential which dominates the politics of the emerging Catholic middle classes. Here's Kieran Wallace.
There's a huge explosion in local voting. There's new local election rules are brought in, and the voting population of Dublin for corporation elections sort of multiplies by about 300%. So people are much more politicised in voting for their local city councillors. Out in the suburbs, they've been developing since the 1840s, 1860s. So you have suburbs like the Rathmines, Rathgar, Pembroke, which is modern-day Donnybrook and Bald Bridge, suburbs down to Blackrock, Monkstown and Kingstown, Dunleary today. They're all doing quite well. They're developing. There's new, very high-end housing being built. I wouldn't say it's a boom town, but there's certainly a solid, prosperous growth of a middle class, and not just what we often tend to think of, this sort of Protestant elite, other English kind of middle class. There's a Catholic, Gaelic, nationalist middle class, maybe Gaelic with a small g, but they're certainly, they see perhaps Home Rule will be good. They're not absolutely convinced, but they certainly see that there's a middle class identity that they share with their unionist neighbours across the suburbs.
I dreamt that I dwelt in marble halls with vassals and serfs at my side, and of all who assembled within those walls, that I was their hope and their pride.
James Joyce captures this in his work. In his short story The Dead, Gabriel and Greta Conroy are part of the new Catholic middle class who have moved to the Southside suburbs. And that Catholic business class begins to shape the city. Here's Mary Daly.
So the city becomes the preserve of a Catholic middle class, a lot of them building their money on pubs, some of them on shops, etc. as well. And they become the dominant force in Dublin Corporation. Quite a number of them as part of their investment go into property, and the property they go into is tenements. So one of the big scandals that comes out in 1914 are the number of Dublin Corporation members who are actually tenement landlords in their own right. So what you have actually is this whole self-reinforcing network of business and tenement housing and pubs and pawnbrokers, etc., all cheek by jowl.
Which charmed me most, that you loved me still the same, that you loved me still the same, that you loved me still the
same. 1904 is the year Joyce leaves Ireland, and it's the timeline for Ulysses itself. The Victorian world has been replaced by new ideas, industries and technologies. The Cork-born businessman William Martin Murphy comes to personify this enterprise class. Now, Murphy had been a Parnellite, but he opposed him in the split. And by this stage, he owns the Irish Independent, Cleary's, the Imperial Hotel and runs the United Dublin Tramway. I'm with Porrick Yates in O'Connell Street, or Saxville Street as it was known then, and it was very much the heart of Murphy's empire. Porrick, who was he? Who was William Martin Murphy?
He was Ireland's richest self-made millionaire at that time. He'd made his money mainly in the tramway companies. He was an exceptionally bright man. For example, when he was involved in the Dublin tramways, a British company came in that electrified its trams, and it was a no contest. People were switching to the British company. Murphy went off to America. He studied electrical engineering. He studied how they ran tram businesses in America. He came back. He electrified the Dublin system. And within a year or so, he'd actually taken over the British competition. So he's an incredibly able man, very intelligent, but deeply conservative, deeply Catholic. He belonged to a group known as the Bantry Band. It included people like Tim Healy, as near a friend as Murphy had. He was a very cold man. And they formed a very powerful bloc within the Home Rule movement. And they saw socialism as a sort of manifestation of Anglo-Saxon modernism.
So, Porrick, when we think about the city, these densely populated inner city tenements, growing Catholic middle class in the suburbs, what's the sectarian breakdown?
One of the peculiarities is there were very few Protestant workers. Sean O'Casey was a very unusual Protestant worker, a very gifted one, but there were very few of them because most of the skilled Protestant working class had actually emigrated during the previous century because they had skills. So while there was a very large Protestant population in Dublin, in fact, had the biggest concentration of Protestants outside of Belfast, over 90,000 people in Dublin city and county were Protestant. They were overwhelmingly middle class. They were employers, they were architects, they were lawyers, they were doctors and so on.
Porrick Yates there, and Porrick is both a lockout historian and a member of the 1913 Commemorative Committee. It's interesting that Porrick makes the point about the decline of both the skilled and the Protestant workforce in the city, with only 10,000 working-class Protestants by 1911. Yet while my maternal grandmother, Lizzie Connolly, was growing up in a Catholic Republican family, my paternal grandfather, John Shaw, is from a Protestant working-class family. He was a sawyer, an apprentice saw doctor to his father, Henry Shaw, living over the shop in Stephen Street, not far from Dublin Castle. In 1904, James Joyce sings this Arthur Sullivan song, No Chastening for the Present, in the Fesh Ceoil.
I will teach you
tenor John McCormack, who became one of the most famous voices of the age, had won the Fesh the year before. In the audience, there's a young couple, Constance and Casimir Markovic. They're at the heart of the artistic and cultural life of the city since returning from Paris. Constance is 36, the privileged daughter of the Gorbooth Lissadale estate in Sligo, and she's become a good friend of Maud Gonne, who really influences her thinking. They're both mothers with young children. Constance's daughter Maeve is 2, and she was at the christening earlier that year of Maud's son, Sean McBride. She's part of an elite cultural movement which brings writers and artists like A.E. Russell and W.B. Yeats into sympathy with the Irish nationalist and socialist movement. Markovic later becomes a close ally of Larkin and Connolly, but her first activism is around the rights of women.
The first step on the road to freedom is to realise ourselves as Irish women, not as Irish or merely as women, but as Irish women doubly enslaved and with a double battle to fight.
That's Constance writing in 1909. By then, she's increasingly radicalised. She's joined Maud Gonne's Éineann na hÉireann, Sinn Féin, and by 1909, she forms na Fianna, a type of Republican Scouts movement that trains boys in firearms. Historian Dermot Ferriter.
There are many individuals who emerge during this period whose background would suggest very little sympathy with the cause of Irish nationalism or the cause of Irish labour, and yet they assume very dominant positions. Constance Markovic is one of those individuals. Herself and her sister were fascinating characters, a very interesting background, and yet they reject so much of that background and so much of that heritage in order to make common cause with the political radicals of the era. And the women are particularly interesting because they are battling a much wider prejudice. If you think of the difficulties that were there for male labour organisers or for male nationalists, and then multiply those difficulties by 10, you might get some sense of what the women of that era were facing. They had to fight on all sorts of different fronts. The first question, of course, for women who were politically active was creating a space for themselves to be heard, finding a place and a space on platforms. There is no vote for women at this stage. There is a very active Irish Women's Franchise League from 1908. There is the Irish Citizens newspaper, which provides a platform for the cause of suffrage. And then there are those individuals who decide, again, suffrage as an issue is something that has to be parked until we achieve our independence.
What I want young Irish women to remember from me: regard yourselves as Irish. Believe in yourselves as Irish, as units of a nation distinct from England. Arm yourselves with weapons to fight your nation's cause. Arm your souls with noble and free ideas.
Markovic would have been particularly polarizing because she was a woman. She was a woman who was extraordinarily politicized. She was a woman who had quite a well-to-do, if not exotic, background. She is somebody who would have been written about in very disparaging terms. And there may have been all sorts of class prejudices that were feeding into that kind of analysis of Markovic. There's little doubting that she had a very deep personal commitment. Few would doubt that there was a lot of courage at the heart of Markovic, though some, of course, would depict her as having been a fraud in that regard.
Two key events in 1907, one in Belfast and one in Dublin, illuminate what is to come. The Liverpool-born trade union leader Jim Larkin is sent to Belfast to organise the dock workers for the National Union of Dock Labourers. While in Dublin, William Martin Murphy is commissioned to organise the Irish International Exhibition, a grand fair in what is now Herbert Park. The Belfast strike by June 1907 sees the emergence of Larkinism and the concept of the sympathy strike, with Larkin's mantra, "An injury for one is an injury for all." While in Dublin, the International Exhibition gets 2.5 million visitors between May to November of that year, and it puts Murphy centre stage as the leading businessman of his age. I'm at the Belfast Docklands, which is now often known as the Titanic Quarter, with Labour historian Emmett O'Connor. Emmett, to understand the Dublin lockout in 1913, we really have to get to grips with what happened here in 1907.
Yeah, in some ways, Belfast 1907 is a clearer guide to Larkinism than Dublin in 1913, because the kind of personalities of Larkin and William Martin Murphy and the slums, of course, tend to overshadow the 1913 struggle.
And what was Belfast like in 1907?
By 1900, it's by far the biggest industrial city in Ireland. And the industry is mainly of two kinds. It's the metal trades, engineering and shipbuilding, which is largely men's work, well-paid, British-based unions. And then you have textiles and clothing, which is largely women's work, low-paid. Only a small number of workers in the sector is unionised. And then Belfast has become very much beset by sectarian problems. It's a city now with a big 25% Catholic minority, and it's developed a somewhat notorious reputation for sectarian violence.
So he's sent here to organise the Dockers. How does it spread to the rest of the city?
Larkin arrived in Belfast certainly willing to apply the union's policy of organising Dockers only and avoiding confrontation, because his boss, James Sexton, reckoned that the employers were just too militant and, if at all possible, the union should avoid strikes. And Sexton didn't want the union organising people like Carters and so on. The union had enough on its plate organising Dockers as far as Sexton was concerned. So Larkin applies that policy initially, but other groups like Carters, general labourers, come to him and ask him to organise these sectors. But he soon finds that Irish employers are very militant. They'll accept crafts unions, okay, because the craftsman is seen as responsible and respectable. But they think that trade unionism is too dangerous a weapon to put in the hands of the unskilled labourer. By June of 1907, he's confronted with a number of sectional disputes and lockouts, and he decides to escalate them into a general strike in the port. And this is something entirely new. It's something that we didn't have in the Irish labour movement before. And Larkin realises that if you want to outflank Irish employers, you need a much wider kind of organisation, much broader strike tactics. Above all, you need sympathetic action if you're going to take them on, because the employers will stick together. So Larkin argues it's essential that the workers will stick together too.
An injury for one is an injury for all. Not as Catholics or Protestants, as nationalists or unionists, but as Belfastmen and workers, stand together and don't be misled by the employers' game of dividing Catholic and Protestant.
Larkin calls the Belfast dock strike because the employers, led by tobacco merchant Thomas Gallagher, refuse to recognise the unions. Other workers, including women from the tobacco factory, come out in sympathy. It famously unites Protestant and Catholic, even sparking solidarity with the RIC policemen. The strike runs for 4 months, but ultimately fails. It's called off by Larkin's boss, James Sexton, but marks the beginning of Larkin's alienation from the Dockers Union and the creation of Larkin's own union, the Transport and General Workers Union, by January 1909. That idea of union representation for all, for both skilled and unskilled, is at the core of the Dublin lockout 6 years later.
By and large, what happened in 1907 for Larkinism was seen to be a setback. But when Larkin was defeated, his instinct was to move on, and he moved on to Dublin.